Hello, this is William Fink, and this is Christigenia Internet Radio. Today is Friday, August 8th, 2025. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. I was a little late getting started this evening. I had last-minute hardware problems. The mouse on my streaming computer just didn't want to work. I had to steal a mouse from one of my laptops after several attempts to use the laptop to stream this podcast, and that didn't work either for some strange reason, because I had it running a month ago or two. The last time I used it, I've used it for a podcast. I apologize for the delay. This is a commentary on Isaiah, and it's part 40, The Light of Judgment. I will have a long digression this evening in reference to the first four verses of Isaiah chapter 42. And then we will present verses 5 through 9. So I will only get five more verses into Isaiah. We're just racing to chapter 66. What can I say? It is what it is. I wouldn't shorten this for anything, really. In our last presentation of this commentary on Isaiah, the test of God, discussing Isaiah chapter 41. We had witnessed a description of the test of God as it was attributed to Yahweh God himself through the words of Isaiah his prophet. And the valid conclusion for Christians must be that only God, the God of the Bible, has revealed the past as well as the future. And by that we should know that he is God. Of course, the proof that he has done this is found only through the study of his prophets alongside the subsequent events of history, which demonstrate that his word has been and is true. So for that reason alone, men should dispense of their idols and worship and obey him in ways that are also revealed in his word. Having done that, we began our commentary for Isaiah chapter 42, but we only presented the first four verses of the chapter. So we will repeat them here so that we may discuss at length a different aspect of the message which they contain. Behold my servant, whom I uphold, mine elect, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He shall bring forth judgment to the nations. He shall not cry, nor lift up, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed shall he not break, and the smoking flax shall he not quench. He shall bring forth judgment unto truth. He shall not fail nor be discouraged till he has set judgment in the earth, and the isle shall wait for his law. When we interpreted verse 2, we made the assertion that this prophecy could refer to the children of Israel collectively once they received the gospel of Christ, but that it pertains much more precisely to Yahshua Christ himself, the subject of the gospel which they are to receive. Declarations are made in chapter 41, as well as in subsequent chapters of this prophecy, that Jacob is Yahweh's servant. So we also made the assertion that even in apostasy and captivity, Jacob, referring to the children of Israel collectively, is Yahweh's servant, because whether or not they comply willingly or even knowingly, they are nevertheless accomplishing the will of Yahweh in the world, which is something which they shall do even in spite of themselves. In the various promises to Abraham, Jacob, and later to Joseph, in Genesis chapters 12 through 17, and chapters 35 and 48, the children of Israel were both promised and prophesied to become great nations, companies of nations, and a multitude of nations. In Genesis chapter 48, Joseph inherited the double portion of the birthright and the promises which had been made by God to Abraham, his father. Then when Jacob further blessed his sons, in Genesis chapter 49, he declared, Joseph is a fruitful bow, even a fruitful bow by a well, whose branches run over the wall, which means that the posterity of Joseph would overflow their border. Just like you have a hedge and the branches run far over the fence and your neighbor threatens to cut them off. So in the Song of Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 33, we also read, and for the precious things of the earth and the fullness thereof, and for the goodwill of him that dwelt in the bush, let the blessing come upon the head of Joseph. Those words are significant because Moses is reiterating what Jacob had said in Genesis chapter 48. And upon the head of him, and this is simply a Hebrew parallelism, it says the same thing in slightly different language, and upon the top of the head of him that was separated from his brethren, his glory is like the firstling of his bullock, and his horns are like the horns of unicorns. Unicorns is a bad translation there. With them he shall push the people together to the ends of the earth. And they are the ten thousands of Ephraim, and they are the thousands of Manasseh. The children of Israel would indeed fulfill these promises, but they could not have fulfilled them in the tiny land which they had originally been allotted in Palestine. And the word of God also acknowledged that elsewhere. For example, in Isaiah chapter 49, verse 18, the children of Israel are portrayed as saying, this place is too straight for me. Give me place that I may dwell. In Deuteronomy chapter 32, we read, when the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. While this reading is contested by some modern scholars, because it is not consistent in ancient sources, the King James translation is attested in many other versions, such as the New American Standard Bible and the Latin Vulgate and its translation by Douay Rheims. Strangely, the Septuagint has angels of God rather than children of Israel. And the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, following the fragment identified as 4Q Deuteronomy J, has children of God. This creates a conflict because, as we read in Luke chapter 3, Adam was the son of God, and therefore all of the descendants of Adam are children of God. Something which Paul of Tarsus acknowledged in his proclamation to the Athenians, who were the descendants of Javan, the son of Japheth, in Acts chapter 17, verse 28, that they are all children of God. However, the hexapla of Origen attests that both his Hebrew copy and the old Latin text had sons of Israel, which was also apparently attested by Aquila of Sinope and Theodotion in their Greek translations. In that same place in the hexapla, as well as in the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, sons of Israel is said to have been attested in the Samaritan Pentateuch. Evidently, the land of Canaan was not the land or the only land set aside for Israel, since the tribes descended from Canaan had occupied it long before the Exodus, and since Israel had taken a land from Canaan rather than having been moved to lands which had not been inhabited by others of the sons of Adam. Ostensibly, there were other reasons for the conquest of Canaan, and the promise of a greater Israel to Abraham, which had been fulfilled in the days of David. But that land alone was not the land of their destiny. So in words which had been spoken by the prophet Nathan to David himself, we read in 2 Samuel chapter 7, at verse 8, "Now therefore, so shalt thou say unto David my servant, thus saith Yahweh of hosts, I took thee from the sheepcote and from following the sheep to be ruler over my people Israel. And I was with thee whithersoever thou wentest, I was with thee wherever you went, and have cut off all thine enemies out of thy sight, and have made thee a great name, like unto the name of the great men that are in the earth. Moreover," and this is the significant passage here, "moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own, and move no more. Neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them any more as before time." That land to which they would move could not have been in Palestine, because Nathan had spoken those words to David in Palestine, in Jerusalem. So evidently there was some other place outside of Israel to which Israel would be permanently moved at some point in the future, subsequent to the time of David. But it is also evident that the process of that moving began even earlier, before the time of David. As we have mentioned earlier in this commentary, the Phoenicians, who had settled Europe and the coast of Africa, the Danann Greeks, the Dorian Greeks, and even the Trojans, may all be traced back to either Israel in captivity in Egypt, or to the seaports of Israel in Palestine. And especially in these cases, those of Dor and Tyre. We shall not elaborate on those assertions here. However, it is also apparent that the Israelites who had migrated in the earliest time, those who departed the main body of Israel in Egypt by sea, would not have had the laws of Moses given at Sinai. Later, Paul of Tarsus had commended the Romans, descendants of the Trojans, for establishing a society based on the rule of law, where in Romans chapter 2 he wrote, "For not the hearers of the law are just before God, but the doers of the law shall be justified. For when the nations which have not the law do by nature the things contained in the law, these, having not a law, are a law unto themselves." The laws of Rome did not perfectly coincide with those of Moses, but they did protect the people and punish men for committing many of the same deeds which the law of Moses condemns. And as Paul continues, he also explains how, like Moses, the Romans gave a man who was accused a right to be heard at trial. So as we continue, the language in verse 15 of that chapter is rather archaic. So we will also offer our own version, which show the working law written in their hearts, their conscience always also bearing witness, and their thoughts the mean while accusing or else excusing one another. And we will clarify that. In the day when God shall judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to my gospel. We would read verse 15 to say, and we have in the Christogenia New Testament, who exhibit the work of the law written in their hearts, bearing witness with their conscience, and between one another, considering accusations, or then defending the accused. And the King James used very simple and rather crude language to express that. So Paul was commending the Romans for evaluating evidence before condemning a man. Saying that, Paul had also described the Romans as having fulfilled the promise which Yahweh God had made to Israel, which is found in Jeremiah chapter 31. This establishes that the Romans must have been descendants of ancient Israelites who had departed from Egypt. They had to have departed from Egypt because they didn't have the law, but yet they kept the works of the law. The law written, the exhibit of the law written in their hearts, as Paul said in verse 15 of this chapter of Romans. And he was referring to Jeremiah chapter 31, where we read, "But this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, saith Yahweh, I will put my law in their inward parts and write it in their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people." Nowhere do we see this promise made to Gentiles or to non-Israelites. However, later in the epistle, in Romans chapter 11, he compared them to wild olives, contrasted to the cultivated olives, which were the Israelites of Judea who had been raised with the law. That is also why Paul wrote here that having not the law, they exhibited the law written in their hearts, something which Yahweh God had promised to Israel. But Paul never described the Corinthians as wild olives. Instead, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he said to them that, "Moreover, brethren, I would not," that means I do not wish, that ye should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all did eat the same spiritual meat, and all did drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. So the ancestors of the Corinthians were baptized in the cloud and the sea with Moses, as well as the ancestors of Paul. Therefore, if we believe Paul, we must examine how that could be so. It can be established in ancient history that the Corinthians were Dorian Greeks, just as the people of many of the cities of the Peloponnesus, such as the Spartans. In Greek literature, the earliest mention of Dorian Greeks is in the Odyssey of Homer, in Book 19, where they were described only as being on the island of Crete. Crete is a large island in the Mediterranean, of which the easternmost shore is about 250 miles from Athens. and 500 miles from the location of ancient Dor in Palestine. There is a second witness to this connection, which is a letter that had been recorded in both 1 Maccabees chapter 12 and by Flavius Josephus in his Antiquities of the Judeans in book 12. The letter was written by a Spartan king to a high priest of Jerusalem named Onias in the early 2nd century BC. As Josephus had recorded it, according to Whiston's translation, we read Arius, the name of the king, Arius, king of the Lacedaemonians. That's Lacedaemonians. We may pronounce that reading modern books, but it's Lacedaemonians in Greek. That's the southeasternmost district of the Peloponnesus, where the city of Sparta was. So Arius was really also king of the Spartans. Arius, king of the Lacedaemonians, to Onias, sends greetings. We have met with a certain writing whereby we have discovered that both the Judeans, I won't say Jews, that's not proper at this point in history, and the Lacedaemonians are of the same family and are derived from the kindred of Abraham. It is but just, therefore, that you, who are our brethren, nobody ever would have called the Spartans Jews, should send to us about any of your concerns as you please. We will also do the same thing and esteem your concerns as our own, and will look upon our concerns as in common with yours. Demodales, who brings you this letter, will bring your answer back to us. This letter is foursquare, and the seal is an eagle with a dragon in his claws. The Jews were in the claws of the eagle. That's the only place they were in this letter. The Judeans of the time, who were very guarded concerning their heritage, could not have contrived this story. The same Judeans would not even entertain the claims of certain of their neighboring Samaritans to being Israel, even if they were, on account of the fact that they no longer had their genealogies, which for which reason the Judeans had always despised the Samaritans. Yet Christ himself did not deny the validity of the claim of the woman at the well in Samaria, who had asked him, "Art thou greater than our father Jacob, which gave us this well, and drank thereof himself and his children and his cattle?" The Judeans rejected those claims. So how should they accept the claim of the Spartan king? However, they certainly did accept it. And Paul's words in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 are verification of their veracity. In turn, the Dorians, and especially the Spartans, are often recorded as having expressed pride in their own mythical origin. So why should they admit to having a humble heritage such as that of Abraham? We cannot assume that the pagan king of Sparta understood the scriptures and the promises of God, even whether or not he believed that Hercules was his progenitor. Heracles, I should have said. That's a long story, too. Which was a common belief in Sparta, that they believed that Heracles was their ancestor. However, the children of Israel never kept Moses. And in their nations abroad, they'd always been pagans. They worshipped the calves of Baal and many other ancient abominations, which can be traced to Canaan, Egypt, and Mesopotamia. Minos, king of Crete, to whom is credited the Minotaur, was said to have been the son of Europa, a Phoenician woman of Tyre. Minos was said to have sacrificed young men and women to this Minotaur, or bull of Minos, which is what it means, much like the sacrifices of children to Moloch. The Greeks and others who migrated to the shores of the Mediterranean had also partaken in many other detestable practices. And even when they did not, they had nevertheless tolerated such practices among others in their communities. Here we shall give a few examples of their corruption from ancient Greek literature. And the point in all this is that understanding how corrupt they were, we can understand the impact of the light of judgment, which was to come upon them in Christ. In the Iliad, Book 5, the Achaean hero, Diomedes, the king of Argos, is portrayed as having expressed the hope of being able to steal certain Trojan horses in battle. And he's portrayed as having said, in part, "They are of the stock, the great Jove." Now, some classicists who make these translations insist on replacing Greek names with Latin names, which I don't agree with, even if they are roughly describing the same character in the minds of either Greeks or Romans. I don't agree with that. So Jove is really Zeus in Greek writings, such as Homer, especially before Homer probably ever heard of Latin. "They are of that stock that great Zeus gave to Tros in payment for his son Ganymede, and are the finest that live and move under the sun. King Anchises stole the blood by putting his mares to them without Laomedon's knowledge. And they bore him 6 foals, 4 are still in his stables, but he gave the other 2 to Aeneas. We shall win great glory if we can take them." Laomedon was the grandson of Tros, and he became the king of Troy and the father of Priam. Priam was the king of Troy at the time of its fall. While Aeneas was a nephew of Laomedon by his sister, according to the common mythology. So Tros was depicted as having accepted horses from Zeus in exchange for his own son Ganymede, a concept which should be completely odious to Christians, but which had been celebrated by Greek writers for many centuries. Then, in Iliad Book 20, we further read of Ganymede, where Aeneas is portrayed as the speaker. These words are put in the mouth of Aeneas, the same Aeneas who was later the legendary founder of Rome, and Strabo of Cappadocia and other early historians accepted that myth as being historical. So there must be some truth behind it. So in Iliad Book 20, Aeneas is portrayed as having said, "Erichthonius begot Tros, king of the Trojans. And Tros had 3 noble sons." Erichthonius was a direct ancestor of Darda or Dardanus. There's a couple of generations between them, I think. I don't really remember very well. "And Tros had 3 notable sons, Ilus." It's after Ilus that Troy was also sometimes called Ilium. "Asarchus and Ganymede, who was comeliest of mortal men. Wherefore, the gods carried him off to be Zeus's cupbearer, for his beauty's sake, that he might dwell among the immortals. Ilus begot Laomedon, and Laomedon begot Tithonus, Priam, Lampus, Clytius, and Hecataeon of the stock of Mars. But Assaracus was father to Capys, Capys to Anchises, who was mentioned in the in the passage that we had cited earlier from book 5 of Iliad, who was my father, the father of Aeneas, while Hector is son to Priam. While Homer spoke of Zeus's abduction of Ganymede in rather glowing terms, he did not make any explicit references to a sexual relationship. But he did describe Ganymede's beauty as the reason for which Zeus had wanted the young man for himself. However, perhaps 150 years later, there certainly were such sexually explicit references made in Greek literature. So what follows are words attributed to an unnamed Phrygian in Euripides' play titled Orestes. The title character, Orestes, was the son of Agamemnon, who was ill-fated because he had avenged the blood of his father by killing his own mother, because both she, Clytemnestra, and her lover had murdered him after he returned home from the Trojan War. The reference here to the horsemanship of Ganymede is descriptive of the horses which Zeus was said to have given Tros in exchange for his son. So the unnamed Phrygian is portrayed as having said, "Ilium, Ilium." And as I said, they are references to Troy. "O me, city of Phrygia." And this is a Phrygian perspective that Homer is attributing to this unnamed Phrygian. Troy was not really considered part of Phrygia. "City of Phrygia and Ida's holy hill with fruitful soil. How I mourn for your destruction. A shrill song with barbarian cry." Homer also often, and other poets did this as well. The tragic poets did the same thing. And it's kind of funny. They depicted the non-Greek speaking peoples, whom they call barbarians, as admitting for themselves that they were barbarians, which you probably wouldn't want to do. If a Mexican calls you a gringo, a white man, you're probably not going to want to call yourself a gringo and accept that label. But the tragic poets and the epic poets had these barbarians calling themselves barbarian, and I think it's kind of funny. "How I mourn for your destruction, a shrill song with barbarian cry. Destroyed through her beauty, born from a bird, swan-feathered, laid as cub, hellish Helen." In other words, Troy was destroyed on account of Helen. "To be accursed to Apollo's tower of polished stone. Ah, alas, woe to Dardania. It's wailing, wailing for the horsemanship of Ganymede, bedfellow of Zeus." Euripides was a tragic poet who lived from about 480 to 406 BC. In another play by Euripides titled Cyclops, which tells of one of the adventures of Odysseus in the aftermath of the Trojan War, the name of Ganymede is evoked for comparative purposes by the Cyclops, the one-eyed giant who had the the one-eyed giant who had the intention of raping a man named Silenus. And perhaps I should use comparative purposes with the Cyclops there. I'm sorry, I'm stumbling. So we read in part, and this is attributed, these words are attributed to the Cyclops. This is a play, so it goes back and forth, and there's some descriptions of what the characters are doing as they speak the words. So the Cyclops, that would be Kuklops in Greek, never Cyclops, Kuklops. The Cyclops says, "Ha ha, what a trouble it was getting out. This is pleasure unalloyed." In other words, pure pleasure. Earth and sky seem whirling round together. I see the throne of Zeus and all the Godhead's majesty. Kiss thee. No, there are the graces trying to tempt me. I shall rest well enough with my Ganymede here. Yeah, by the graces right fairly, for I like lads better than the wenches. In other words, the Cyclops is a sodomite. He likes young men better than women. So Silenus, the object of his pleasure, exclaims, what? Cyclops, am I Ganymede, Zeus's minion? And here in these first few lines, the Cyclops professes to prefer sodomy over the companionship of a woman, and Silenus immediately recalls the perceived relationship of Zeus and Ganymede, which had been suggested by the Cyclops. So sodomy is acceptable for one's god. It must be acceptable for all those who worship such a god. Now, where we continue, the Cyclops is portrayed as accepting the allegory in reference to Silenus. And this states that the Cyclops is attempting to carry him into a cave and says, to be sure, Ganymede, whom I am carrying off from the halls of Dardanus. So Silenus responds, I am undone, my children. The Cyclops is a giant. There's no opposing him. Outrageous treatment awaits me. So now the leader of the chorus makes an exclamation. And the chorus in the Greek tragic poets is sometimes identified simply as townspeople who happen to stumble across the scene, or family members or friends of those involved in the main scene. I'm not certain who the chorus is here. It doesn't really matter. But the leader of the chorus says, dost, meaning do you, find fault with thy lover? Dost scorn him in his cups? Silenus says, woe is me. Most bitter shall I find the wine ere long or before long. And the next line in the play is, Silenus is dragged into the cave by the Cyclops. So he's done. In the way in which this is presented by Euripides, the other men who were portrayed as having been present, including Odysseus, were not hostile to the idea that Silenus would be raped by the Cyclops. And neither is the leader of the chorus, who actually chided Silenus for having raised objections. Silenus is portrayed as having considered the prospect of his rape outrageous, but not on any firm moral basis, because pagans have no firm moral basis for objecting to rape or to sodomy, especially when their own gods also frequently enjoy such perversions. How can a man object if God does it? This view of the fate of Ganymede, as it was suggested by Euripides, was also expressed in the Library of Apollodorus, where he described the so-called labors of Heracles. Apollodorus in his library sought to summarize, and it is a really good overview, in my opinion, even though I've read most of the, or at least many of the older poets. I wouldn't say most, but it might be. The Library of Apollodorus seeks to take all that information and summarize the acts of all these gods and what they were famous for doing. And He offers many contrary or contrasting versions of the same story where they differ in significant ways. So it's a good go-to reference for a quick rundown on any ancient Greek mythical figure. Let me put it that way. So where he described the so-called labors of Heracles, he basically repeated this same view of the fate of Ganymede. Here we also see another cause which had attributed to the Trojan War rather than the mere taking of Helen by Alexandros. And if you're not familiar with that story, and this isn't in my notes, but I can repeat it, Alexandros, whom the Romans in their version of the story called Paris, had went to Greece from Troy. He was a son of Priam, and he wasn't the crown prince, that was Hector, but he was one of the sons of Priam who were princes of Troy, and he went to visit Menelaus, who at that time was the king of Sparta, and Menelaus was the brother of Agamemnon, the king of Mycenae, who was the actual leader of the Greeks in the wars against the Trojans. Well, Alexandros went to Sparta to visit with Menelaus, and he stole his wife, Helen. When Menelaus was called away on some important business, he stole Helen and disappeared with her. And there are many different accounts. He took her to Egypt. He took her to Troy. He took her to Troy, and she was in Egypt, so that when Troy fell, she wasn't there. So there's varying stories about the aftermath of that, written by different early poets. And that's not really important. But that act was what is said by all sources to have attributed, to have sparked, or was the catalyst for the Trojan War and the destruction of Troy. So this elucidates not only the depravity of the ancient Greeks, but also the cruelty which they had attributed to the very gods which they had worshipped. So where the author here, whoever Apollodorus is citing, unless he wrote this from his own words, where the author is speaking of Pergamum, a city not far from Troy, we read, and Pergamum isn't really a famous city until this second century BC in the time of Apollodorus, but it started to rise to prominence in the fourth century BC. So we read, but it chanced that the city was then in distress. Consequently, on the wrath of Apollo and Poseidon, and he's speaking of Troy. For desiring to put the wantonness of Laomedon to the proof, Apollo and Poseidon assumed the likeness of men and undertook to fortify Pergamum for wages. I will remark on that later. But when they had fortified it, he would not pay them their wages. Therefore, Apollo sent a pestilence and Poseidon a sea monster. And let me clarify that Pergamum was a city in the Troad, but it wasn't Troy, it was south of Troy. There Apollo sent a pestilence and Poseidon a sea monster, which, carried up by a flood, snatched away the people of the plain. But as oracles foretold deliverance from these calamities, if Laomedon would expose his daughter Hesiod to be devoured by the sea monster, he exposed her by fastening her to the rocks near the sea. Seeing her exposed, Heracles promised to save her on condition of receiving from Laomedon the mares, these horses again, which Zeus had given in compensation for the rape of Ganymede. On Laomedon saying that he would give them, Heracles killed the monster and saved Hesiod. But when Laomedon would not give the stipulated reward, because any man can screw a god out of what he owes him, Heracles put to sea after threatening to make war on Troy. The Greeks claimed to worship these gods, and they were really a joke, in other words. Here and throughout their own literature, the Greeks describe their own gods as having had many faults and limitations, as if gods should need to be paid for their work, or as if they could only depart while threatening men when they were robbed by them of their expected payment. This Apollodorus was an Athenian, but there seems to be some propaganda concerning Pergamum in this passage, because the city was quite obscure before the 4th century BC. However, during the very time that Apollodorus had written, the middle of the 2nd century BC, the city was at the height of its political power under the Italian kings. And it was still independent of Rome, to which it was also a willing, loyal ally in the Macedonian Wars. But regardless of the perceived propaganda, the reference to the rape of Ganymede corroborates the descriptions found in Euripides, where he had also portrayed Ganymede as having been raped by Zeus. Why else would an old man have been so captivated by the beauty of a very young man that he kidnapped him and took him home? The Greeks had often mentioned homosexual relationships and other sins in passing, such as are found in Book 2 of the Geography of Strabo of Cappadocia, speaking of a coastal town called Leucas, which means white, which was in Acarnania, a district in the mainland of southwestern Greece, where we read, and this is Strabo, Book 2, Chapter 9, it contains the temple of Apollo Leucadas, and also the Leap, which was believed to put an end to the longings of love. Jumping from a high rock into the sea would certainly do that. It would put an end to the one who's longing. And it continues and says, where Sappho is said to have been the first, as Menander says, Strabo is citing Menander, when through frantic longing she was chasing the haughty Phaon, to fling herself with a leap from the far-seen rock, calling upon thee in prayer, O Lord and Master. And there Menander was probably addressing Apollo. Now, although Menander says that Sappho was the first to take the leap, yet those who are better versed than he in antiquities, this is Strabo speaking, say that it was Cephalus, that word actually means head or of the head, who was in love with Pterolaus, the son of Deioneus. It was an ancestral custom among the Leucadians. Every year, the sacrifice performed in honor of Apollo, for some criminal to be flung from this rocky lookout for the sake of averting evil. Now they try to clean this up a little bit. Wings and birds of all kinds being fastened to him, since by their fluttering they could lighten the leap. You wouldn't land as hard. Maybe you'll survive. And also for a number of men stationed all around below the rock in small fishing boats to take the victim in, and when he had been taken on board, to do all in their power to get him safely outside their borders. Throwing petty criminals off a high peak, for which they probably may not even survive, is not the law of justice in which Paul had written concerning the Romans. Sappho was a woman with a renowned lyric and a renowned lyric poet. I have her writings here. I still haven't had a chance to read them. I have to read them before I ever do a commentary on Jeremiah, for reasons I will divulge when I ever do that commentary, hopefully in the near future. Fragments of her work survive to this day. She is described as having written lovingly of women to the point where many suspect her of having been a lesbian. But the story of her undying love for Phaon seems to dispute the claims. She was a contemporary of Jeremiah, probably having been born around 620 BC. So I should call her a late contemporary of Jeremiah. Jeremiah was probably of age by 620 BC. As for the affair between Cephalus and Pterilus, which was described here, Cephalus, who was in love with Pterilus, the son of Deioneus, while Strabo was quite restrained, he nevertheless did not offer any condemnation of the outcome or its cause. But other and earlier writers actually celebrated sodomy in the form which they had considered most acceptable, which was pederasty. At least many Greek writers had often openly approved of sexual relationships between men and boys, and Pindar was certainly one of them. The fact that pederasty was generally tolerated is evident in the fact that these works were distributed and preserved. So this we may see in Pindar, a poet who lived from about 518 to 438 BC, and whose main subjects were the various Olympic Games and their athletes. He celebrated the winners at the various events in the Games. His poems are arranged in a series for each of the Games about which he had written. Among these were Olympian, Pythian, Nemean, and Isthmian odes. There were different Olympic Games every 4 years at Olympus and Nemea and on the Isthmus, Isthmian, wherever they were held, I'm not sure. And the Pythian Games, there were different Olympic Games held every 4 years at the Olympiad. That's the point of keeping a calendar based on those 4 year periods. They must have been at different times during the year because Pindar seems to have attended them all. I mean, he celebrated their athletes at least. He also had a large number of more general songs separated into various categories reflecting their form and style. While the Greek poets celebrated pederasty, they sometimes expressed disdain for relationships between grown men, unless perhaps it was between men and gods. So in Olympian 1, the first of the Olympian odes, we read from line 23, Syracuse's horse-loving king. Fame shines for him in the colony of brave men founded by Lydian Pelops. A Lydian named Pelops is the legendary founder of Syracuse in Sicily, with whom mighty earthholder Poseidon fell in love. After Clotho pulled him from the pure cauldron, distinguished by his shoulder, gleaming with ivory. The name of this king was Hieron. But here the Greek god Poseidon is portrayed as having fallen in love with Pelops, a grown man. The name Clotho belonged to one of the three fates of Greek mythology. There were nine muses, there were only three fates. A little further on in the same poem is another reference to pederasty, and it mentions Ganymede in comparison. From line 35. It is proper for a man to speak well of the gods, for less is the blame. Son of Tantalus, of you I shall say, contrary to my predecessors, that when your father invited the gods to his most orderly feast and to his friend Sipylus, giving them a banquet in return for theirs. Then it was that the Lord of the splendid trident, that would be Poseidon, seized you, his mind overcome by desire, and with golden steeds conveyed you to the highest home of widely honored Zeus, who was a pederast and a sodomite and a rapist and a lot of other things, where at a later time Ganymede came as well for the same service to Zeus. So we have Ganymede doing the same thing to Zeus that Poseidon had done to Pelops out of the desires of his lust, his lustful, unnatural, sodomite desires. These are Greek gods. These are who the Greeks worshipped. If it's okay with the gods, then they can't have a problem with it themselves. The depravity of the ancient pagan world is more apparent in many more aspects than what we have presented here. This is a subject I could talk about for a year, perhaps, or months at least. Not only were the Greeks morally corrupted, they projected their corruption onto their own idols. Yahweh God had formed man in his image, but apostate men form their false gods in their own corrupt images. So according to their own myths, Zeus and Apollo were both serial rapists. I should say Zeus and Apollo and the other so-called gods were all serial rapists, but also frequently enjoyed the sexual pleasures of many women voluntarily through the, as it is described throughout the Greek poets. I needed some editing here, I'm sorry. In our recent commentary on Genesis chapter 6, titled The Sins of Men and Angels, we described dozens of the rape cases of the rape of women by Zeus or Apollo, which were celebrated by the poets. The Germanic pagan gods were also described in the same manner, where Odin is a fitting rival for Zeus in this pattern of degeneracy. As a digression, classicists who translate ancient Greek literature often use the word nymph to describe women, and quite often the women who voluntarily give themselves to these gods for sexual trysts. So in English lore, a nymph is often portrayed as some mystical being who is something other than human. But in Greek language, the word nymphe primarily describes a wife, or especially a bride, and then secondarily a marriageable maiden, a maiden of marrying age. So the Greek gods were not having sexual intercourse with forest creatures. This isn't My Little Pony. Rather, they were deflowering virgins or violating some man's wife. Once again, if one's gods can engage in such corruption, on what moral basis can it possibly be unacceptable for men? It was this to which Paul of Tarsus had referred in Ephesians chapter 2, where he wrote in part, "Where in time past ye walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now works in the children of disobedience, among whom also we all had our conversation or conduct in modern language in times past, in the lust of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature the children of wrath, even as the others, even like that giant Cyclops, who was a straight pervert. Then a little further on, in chapter 4 of that epistle, Paul wrote once again, speaking of the depravity of their ancestors, and said, who being past feeling have given themselves over unto lasciviousness to work all uncleanness with greediness. Betting nymphs, betting young boys just because they're beautiful. Then reading further, he offered a corrective reprimand. But ye have not learned so, I'm sorry, but you have not so learned Christ. That's also clunky kind of language. If so be that ye have heard him and have been taught by him, as the truth is in Jesus, that ye put off concerning the former conversation the old man, which is corrupt according to the deceitful lusts, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that ye put on the new man, which after God is created in unrighteousness and true holiness. And I can't help but think that Paul of Tarsus had read all these same stories, and he must have been speaking about poor Ganymede and men such as Silenus, who didn't want to go along, but you can't argue with a giant, which the Cyclops were giants. They were described as being powerful. They were probably much the same as those giants such as Og of Bashan and Goliath and the Anakim that the children of Israel were afraid to fight with. The Apostle Peter also addressed this in chapter 1 of his first epistle. For as much as ye know that ye were not redeemed with corruptible things such as silver and gold, from your vain conversation received by tradition from your fathers. And again, that word conversation in modern English would be conduct. But with the precious blood of Christ as of a lamb without blemish and without spot, who verily was foreordained before the foundation of the world, but was manifest in these last times for you, who by him do believe in God that raised him up from the dead and gave him glory, that your faith and hope might be in God, not in rapists and pederasts. Muslims are pederasts. Jews are pederasts. Christians are not pederasts. While Paul had extolled the Romans for developing a society based on a rule of law, pagans are also pederasts. He nevertheless criticized them for their idolatry and discussed its consequences. So in Romans chapter 1, we read, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, which is a word that should really be divinity, so that they are without excuse. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were they thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man, like Zeus and Apollo, and the birds, and four-footed beasts and creeping things like Poseidon. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves, who changed the truth of God into a lie and worshiped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. As a consequence for their idolatry, Paul then explained how they had come to accept other sins, such as sodomy. For this cause, God gave them up to vile affections. For even their women did change the natural use into that which is against nature. They were lesbians. And likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust toward one another. Men with men working that which is unseemly, and receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was meet or fitting. Examples of these wicked practices among the Greeks and Romans are numerous in their own ancient literature. And while there were men who had despised such practices, many more had not despised them, and generally they were even tolerated. The reasons for Paul's words are reflected in the writings of the late 1st century AD chronicler Tacitus in his Germania, remarking on the Germans, but also evidently testifying to conditions in Rome with which he did not agree. He wrote, "No one in Germany finds vice amusing or calls it up to date to seduce and be seduced." Tacitus had marveled at German chastity as compared to Roman depravity, and at the harsh and swift punishment for things such as adultery, which he said was extremely rare, which he said in reference to Germany. Was extremely rare, considering the size of the population. Tacitus also explained that in Germany, traitors, cowards, and men who engaged in sodomy were thrown into the mud bogs and suffocated as a punishment. You know, archaeologists today find these bodies in the mud bogs, these ancient bodies, 1,500, 2,000-year-old bodies in the mud bogs, and we should know that those bodies that are being dug out of the mud bogs today almost certainly fit this description we are going to see here. He wrote in part that cowards, shirkers, and sodomites are pressed down under a wicker hurdle into the slimy mud of a bog. So evidently, Tacitus detested the consequences of idolatry in Rome, of which Paul had warned. But throughout his life, he nevertheless remained an idolater and had even misunderstood and disdained Christianity in his other writings. There are countless other examples of depravity in the ancient pagan world. And once the realization is made that ancient Israelites scattered abroad had been a quite significant proportion of the population of that world, it becomes evident as to how Jacob, and then Christ himself, would fit the description of the righteous man raised up from the east, as we had read in the opening verses of Isaiah chapter 41. And then it also becomes evident as to both how and why we see in the opening verses of this chapter that he shall bring forth judgment to the nations, and he shall bring forth judgment unto truth. He shall not fail nor be discouraged till he has set judgment in the earth, and the isle shall wait for his law. The laws of Yahweh are the light of judgment. As we had explained at length in our commentary for Isaiah chapter 14, titled Lucifer, Son of the Morning, ancient kings considered themselves to be light bearers to the people. For this, we gave the example of Hammurabi, the ancient king of Babylon, who declared that I, am the son of Babylon, who causes light to rise over the land of Sumer and Akkad. The kings of the Egyptians, Hittites, and others had all used similar language to describe themselves as the light of the people or the sun of their lands. But in Revelation chapter 22, Yahshua Christ is attested as having said, I, Jesus, have sent mine angel to testify unto you these things in the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David and the bright and morning star. Earlier, in Revelation chapter 21, in the description of the city of God descended from heaven, we read, and the city had no need of the sun, neither of the moon to shine in it. For the glory of God did lighten it, and the Lamb is the light thereof. This is the same light prophesied here in Isaiah, as Christ had declared in reference to himself, as it is recorded in John chapter 8, I am the light of the world. He that follows me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. So with that, finally, we shall commence where we had left off at this point in Isaiah chapter 42. And this is Isaiah chapter 42, verse 5. Thus saith God Yahweh, he that created the heavens and stretched them out, he that spread forth the earth and that which comes out of it, he that gives breath unto the people upon it, and spirit to them that walk therein. I, Yahweh, have called thee in righteousness, and will hold thine hand, and will keep thee, and give thee for a covenant of the people, for a light of the nations. Interestingly, the last clause of verse 6 in Brenton's translation of the Septuagint reads, and I have given thee for the covenant of a race for light of the nations. It says Gentiles, yes, but I can't read Gentiles because all the words translated as Gentiles only mean nations. And they are words without any particular reference to any particular nation, unless they have a definite article with them, the nations, which would mean particular nations. When Brenton says covenant of a race, that is a literal interpretation of the Greek. Where the Septuagint translators had evidently translated the Hebrew word am, which literally, or I should say, which generally means people, with the Greek word genos, which is primarily a race, stock, or kin, and then offspring, even of a single descendant, according to Liddell and Scott. However, in their definition for Am, Brown Driver Briggs, in their Hebrew lexicon, have people. And they qualify the definition by stating, original meaning, probably, those united, connected, related. And that is certainly reflected in the Septuagint translation of the word here. With this, Jesenius generally agrees in his own definition, where he wrote in part that it is even used of the race or family of anyone. The promises of God were made to only one family, that of Jacob. They weren't made for anyone else. So I prefer the Septuagint rendering here. It's truer. It shouldn't be misconstrued that this light is for any hominid with two legs. It's for a light of the nations, meaning particular nations. It's for a covenant of the people or the race, a particular people or race. The general purpose of the statement is further described in Isaiah chapter 49, and the response to a prayer made to Yahweh God. And he said, "It is a light thing that thou shouldest be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob, and to restore the preserved of Israel. I will also give thee for a light to the nations, that thou mayest be my salvation unto the end of the earth." The horns of Joseph would push his people to the ends of the earth. So the light for the nations described in these passages is a light for the nations of the children of Israel. Those same nations which have been promised to come forth of the loins of Abraham down through Jacob and his descendants. This interpretation of this passage is confirmed, were decided in Luke chapter 2, in a declaration attributed to an elderly man named Simeon, who, having been in the temple in Jerusalem, had seen the Christ child in the arms of his mother and said, "For mine eyes have seen thy salvation, which thou hast prepared before the face of all people. A light to lighten the nations, and the glory of thy people Israel." And Joseph and his mother marveled at those things which were spoken of him. But as for verse 32 in that passage, the word which was translated as lighten is the Greek word apokalypsis, or apocalypse. The same Greek word which stands as the Greek title of the revelation of Christ, because apocalypse describes an uncovering, which is a revelation. The Greek verb kalupto means to cover. An apocalypse is an uncovering. So we translate Luke chapter 2, verse 32 to read. A light for the revelation of the nations, an honor of your people, Israel. The nations are the glory or honor of Israel, of the children of Israel, not the land of Israel. And here the purpose of the Christ is described as having been for them. Now they're described even further, as the purpose of this servant is further illustrated. Isaiah chapter 42, verse 7. The servant still being the servant of the opening chapters, verses of the chapter. To open the blind eyes, to bring out the prisoners from the prison, and them that sit in darkness out of the prison house. At this point, a great number of the children of Israel are in captivity. Even those who left from Egypt, not having joined Moses and receiving the law at Sinai, are technically still in captivity. Being in captivity, having been taken by their enemies, the 142nd Psalm is appropriate to realize the prison allegory. I cried unto Yahweh with my voice. With my voice unto Yahweh did I make my supplication. This is the Psalm of David. I poured out my complaint before him. I showed before him my trouble. When my spirit was overwhelmed within me, then thou knewest my path. In the way wherein I have walked, have they privily laid a snare for me. I looked on my right hand and beheld, but there was no man that would know me. Refuge failed me. No man cared for my soul. I cried unto thee, O Yahweh. I said, thou art my refuge and my portion in a land of the living. Attend unto my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are stronger than I. Bring my soul out of prison, that I may praise thy name. The righteous shall compass me about, for thou shalt deal bountiful with me. When the children of Israel are alienated from their God, they are in prison. That prison could be a prison of depravity. We only have liberty in Christ. So later in this chapter, where it explicitly refers to Israel, in verse 16 we read, and I will bring the blind by a way that they knew not. I will lead them in paths that they have not known. I will make darkness light before them and crooked things straight. These things will I do unto them and not forsake them. Then in verse 22, but this is the people robbed and spoiled. They are all of them snared in holes, rabbi holes, and they are hid in prison houses. I'm sorry. For they are for a prey, and none delivereth, and for a spoil, and none saith, restore. Now Yahweh insists that he himself would do these things for his glory. In verse 8 of Isaiah chapter 42. I am Yahweh, that is my name. And my glory will I not give to another, neither my praise to graven images. As we hope to have elucidated here. Graven images are not simply harmless idols which men worship whimsically. Rather, when men turn away from God to such idolatry, they attribute to their idols the same depravity in which they themselves desire to engage, by which they also seek to justify their depravity. So as Paul had explained in Romans chapter 1, depravity is the result of apostasy and the inevitable consequence of idolatry. Prison is a place where one awaits judgment. And very similar to the allegory in the 142nd Psalm, we read a prophecy of Christ himself in Isaiah chapter 53. He was taken from prison and from judgment. And who shall declare his generation? For he was cut off in the land of the living. For the transgression of my people was he stricken. Another statement found later in these chapters of Isaiah declares the purpose of Christ once again, where in Isaiah chapter 61, being released from captivity is described as the opening of the prison. So being alienated from God is being in prison. The Spirit of Yahweh God is upon me, because Yahweh has anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to them that are bound. The Israelites of the captivity weren't in literal prisons. Rather, they were in far-off nations, but alienated from their God. They were without their God. They were worshiping Zeus, the pedophile, and Apollo, the pervert, and Poseidon. Wow. And they were all rapists, as well as pedophiles and perverts. This passage here from Luke chapter 61, from Isaiah chapter 61, was cited by Christ in reference to himself at the synagogue in Nazareth, as it is described in Luke chapter 4. Now it is apparent that Yahweh God makes a reference to the things formerly prophesied, and these new things which are now being prophesied in these final chapters of Isaiah. So he's basically repeating the test of God right here in verse 9 of chapter 42. Behold, the former things are come to pass, and new things do I declare. Before they spring forth, I tell you of them. If the children of Israel had known beforehand the truth of the matters which we have discussed here in relation to this chapter of Isaiah, then they would have recognized the truth of the statement, and upon receiving the gospel of Christ, they should have realized that this was indeed Yahweh their God who had come to release them from the prison house by reconciling them to himself. But they were also blinded by the will of God, so that his will could be fulfilled, as it is written in Isaiah chapter 6. And he said, go and tell this people, hear ye indeed, but understand not, and see ye indeed, but perceive not. Make the heart of this people fat, and make their ears heavy, and shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and convert, and be healed. Then I said, and this is Isaiah speaking, then said I, Lord, how long? And he answered, until the cities be wasted without inhabitant, and the houses without man, and the land be utterly desolate, and Yahweh has removed men far away, and there be a great forsaking in the midst of the land. So there is a continued promise that they would be blind, and that Yahweh would lead them. Later in this chapter, verse 16, where we read, and I will bring the blind by a way they knew not. So the children of Israel, scattered abroad, had nevertheless accepted the gospel of Christ, even while they remained in their state of blindness. That acceptance was in fulfillment of his profession in John chapter 10. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. That is the light of judgment, which would also heal their blindness if they would only study his word so that they could see. However, as for his enemies, who were heavily represented among the leaders of the Judeans of his time, in that same place he had said, but you believe not, because you are not my sheep, as I said unto you. Being released from prison into the light of Christ, the children of Israel had abandoned the depravity of their former idolatry, which today we call paganism. Keeping the commandments of Christ, they maintained the commandments of Moses, exclusive of the rituals and other ordinances which are no longer applicable and which were abolished with the Levitical priesthood. So Christian Europeans forsook sodomy, pederasty, and other sins. By that alone, they proved that they were his sheep because they heard his voice and they did his will. However, in very recent times, some of those sins are manifesting themselves once again. As Paul of Tarsus had warned in 2 Timothy chapter 3, however, a similar warning by Peter in 2 Peter chapter 3 is more succinct. There shall come in the last days scoffers, with scoffing, going according to their own desires. So some of us are back to pederasty and rape and adultery and fornication, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers have fallen asleep, all things continue thusly from the beginning of the creation. I am certain that they really would not want to see his coming. Not at all. As long as they're in a state of sin. But the promise of his coming is another subject of prophecy in Isaiah, and it too shall certainly be fulfilled. The former things have now come to pass. And now in this time, many of these new things have also come to pass. Those things which Isaiah had prophesied, which have not yet come to pass, we shall discuss as we encounter them in these last 22 chapters of Isaiah, and we shall see why they have not yet come to pass, since that explanation may certainly be elucidated in the revelation of Yahshua Christ. However, because of these former things which are found prophesied in the Word of God have indeed come to pass, by that test of God, we know that God is true and that the things which remain will not be delayed forever. Now, we are going to take a hiatus from this commentary on Isaiah for several weeks as we embark on a lengthy road trip. I hope to be here with a pre-recorded topical presentation next Friday, something which I have not yet had time to finish, and I hope to host an open forum here on August 22nd. I pray y'all join me. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening.